What an honor it is to be here tonight and to serve you and to just meet some of your incredible people in a really cool part of the country. Just help us to communicate, help people to hear, and may we all learn and grow together. It's in Jesus' name we pray. And if you're comfortable in saying it, just say amen. Hey, let's talk about relationships. If you want insight into relationships, ask kids. Kids are very real. They are very, very vulnerable. And a few years ago, someone asked a group of kids a series of questions about relationships. This is how those kids responded. First question, how do you decide who to marry? Alan is age 10. He said, you got to find somebody who likes the same stuff. Like if you like sports, she should like that you like sports, and she should keep the chips and dip coming. That's Alan. He's 10 years old. Here's the second question. How can a stranger tell if two people are married? Derek, he's age 8. He said, you might have to guess based on whether or not they seem to be yelling at the same kids. That's a great way to tell two people are married. Third question. What do you think your mom and dad have in common? Lori, she's 8. What do you think your mom and dad have in common? Both don't want any more kids. That's Lori. Fourth question. Is it better to be married or to be singled? Single. Anita, age 9. It's better for girls to be single, but not for boys. Boys need somebody to clean up after them. I will say amen to Anita. Here's Theodore. He's age 8. I don't know which is better, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm never going to have sex with my wife. I don't want to get all grossed out. All right, fifth question. What do most people do on a date? What do most people do on a date? Here's Lynette. She's 8 years old. Dates are for having fun. And people should use them to get to know each other. Even boys have something interesting to say if you just listen long enough. Well, that's nice, Lynette. Martin, he's 10. Here's what he said. On the first date, they should tell each other lies. And that usually gets them interested enough to go for a second date. That's Martin. Last question. How would you make a marriage work? That's what we're talking about, right? How would you make a marriage work? Lori, age 8. You've got to wonder about Lori's parents for this answer. If you want to last with your man, I can just imagine Lori saying this. If you want to last with your man, you should wear a lot of sexy clothes, especially underwear that is red and maybe has a few diamonds on it. That's 8-year-old. Here's Ricky, age 10. Here's Ricky. How would you make a marriage work? Tell your wife she looks pretty, even if she looks like she's been ran over by a truck. Let's talk about staying in love. Staying in love. Here's a truth that will come up on the screen. And if you can skip forward past the pictures, then we'll go back to the pictures to the first quote. We know how to fall in love. At least we think we do. But we are dangerously ill-equipped when it comes to staying in love. I want to take a moment to give you a snapshot of my life. I first laid eyes on the girl I married, Janet, when she was a mature 8-year-old girl. And I was an incredibly wise 10-year-old guy. Now, we grew up in Tennessee. And when I say Tennessee, I want you to think out on the backside of nowhere. I know Texas has a lot of backside nowhere kinds of places, and Tennessee does too. And I was part of a small country church. And it was a Pentecostal church, so it was a loud church, which was a pretty cool thing for me because I got to play drums in this really loud, vibrant church. And Sunday night church was a really big deal in this church, so I'm up playing drums, this age of 10. And this 8-year-old blonde-headed girl walks in the back. And I'm like, holy cow, she is amazing. So I start beating the drums louder. It wasn't about the worship of Jesus that night. It was about getting the attention of this 8-year-old girl. I started twirling sticks. I started causing any commotion I could cause to get the attention of this girl. Now, amazingly, it really was, for me, love at first sight. And somehow, she's blind in one eye. That's the truth, by the way, not just a lie. She instantly fell in love with me. 6 years later, at the age of 16, I was 16, and my first Ford pickup truck, and her daddy, for some reason, let me take her out on our first date. It was an absolute disaster in terms of romantic illusions. Now, what I'm about to say will take me severely down in notches in your opinion of people from Tennessee and Alabama. I already know that I'm up against it in regards to your assessment of my intellect. I'm from Alabama. Before that, I'm from Tennessee. What good comes out of Alabama and Tennessee other than the Alabama Crimson Tide? You don't have to have intellect, maybe, to be that kind of player. But this is going to cause my stock to go even further down. Grew up in a very conservative Pentecostal church where everything that was enjoyable was wrong. If it was fun, it was wrong. If it made you smile, it was wrong. If it made a woman look halfway attractive, it was wrong. That was the environment that I grew up in. And the agenda of this church, and this is not all, I'm not putting everybody in that classification. And guys, I'm not going to share with you my age, but you've got to go back several years. Education was wrong in the viewpoint of my parents. They believed it to be in conflict with the anointing of the Holy Spirit. That's the way they talked about it. So at the age of 18, I was 18, and she was 16, we married. Now, I just want you to think about that. I've got three daughters, 29, 24, 17. If either three of them attempted that, there would be a murder. That's us at 18 and 16. It was an absolute train wreck waiting to happen. The first 5 to 6 years were absolute disaster. And I can't stress that enough. I mean, absolute disaster. See, there was already an equation working against us when we entered marriage. One sinner plus one sinner always equals double trouble. Well, one immature sinner, my wife, plus one even more immature sinner, me, that equals a train wreck. 6 years into marriage, we had our first daughter. We went on a trip maybe 9 months to a year after that first daughter was born, and we found ourselves in a hotel room, backs against one another in a bed, wondering, is this the end? Is this the end? Now, I want to fast forward. And I want to tell you, the mistakes we've made in our relationship, we could write an encyclopedia about. The successes may fill up a 2-page sheet. Here's what I will say. God met us in that hotel. The grace of God was irresistible when it comes to his pull and tug upon our life. And somehow, God began reviving a wrecked relationship. a relationship that had been wrecked with selfishness, and I'll say it out loud, largely on my part. I didn't know how to selflessly love this woman. I thought I was loving her. I thought I was. But it was nothing like what the scriptures speak of. And to be honest and fair, and if she were here, she would say this as well. She didn't know how to love a man. Not really. Both of us doubted one another's motives. Both of us wondered, why is that other person wired that way? Why do they act like that? And yet God met us in that hotel room, and he began healing and restoring and building a relationship. Now, this June we celebrated 34 years. This was taken near our anniversary, and it's all whited out. By the way, the little one, we didn't go all Abraham and Sarah. That's actually our first grandbaby. We have, now he's almost 8 months old. His name is Jack, and he is absolutely amazing. And this is the whole family. This was taken during the same break. And the handsome guy way out there on the end in the bulldog shirt, God bless his heart, he's from Georgia. That's my oldest daughter right next to him. That's Chelsea, and that's her husband, Cody. Our middle daughter, Kaylee. Our youngest daughter, Cameron. 34 years, and Jan and I have her permission to say stuff like this. We've been married 34 years. Maybe 26, 27 of them have been great. And there have been struggles. I don't mean year-long struggles, but I mean struggles. And it is not if you're going to have problems. It's not if. If you think it's an if, you're set up for a boatload of trouble from day one. It is when you have problems. What will you do? You can take that picture down if you would. For whatever reason, I know it wasn't any goodness in my life. And I know, as good as my wife is, because she's one of the most amazing, incredible, joy-filled people on the planet, it wasn't any goodness in her life. The grace of God was irresistible in our lives. It has been irresistible. By that, I mean we have not been able to get out from under the irresistible tug of grace that keeps pulling us back to Jesus. And when he pulls you back to Jesus, he is also going to pull you closer to one another. So let's dive in, and here's what I'm going to do, just so you won't freak out. We'll do the long session right here, okay? Then we're going to take a break, have some fun, eat some dessert. Is that right? And then we'll come back with a shorter session and get you out of here before the stated time is my goal, because I always feel good about under-promising and over-delivering. So that's going to be the whole plan. Look at Matthew 12:25 in your notes. I didn't put any of the scriptures on the screens, just in your notes. So the only thing that I think will appear on the screen most of the time is going to be some illustrations or the fill in the blanks. Every kingdom divided against itself will be ruined. Every city or household divided against itself will not stand. In other words, it's impossible to build a family, a marriage, church, sports team, business team, organization when it is divided. Yet every day we see marriages and homes that are incredibly divided. When it comes to the closest relationships in your life, is your family or marriage divided against itself, or do you have clarity in that relationship about where you're going? There are over 1,500 dating services, 1,500 dating services in America that promise to help two people meet and fall in love. An established 30 to 40 million Americans are now using online dating services. And by the way, that's not the punchline of a joke. I've got a few couples in my church that met online. They're absolutely incredible and hitting on all cylinders, and some of them a few, even several years into marriage. We get a lot of information about falling in love in America, not a lot of information about staying in love. 1979, Mother Teresa was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was asked, what can we do to promote world peace? She didn't hesitate. This was her response. Go home, love your family. And that's what we're going to talk about. Here's going to be the gist of tonight's session. About 30 years ago, two college professors, a university professor at University of Nebraska and another at Alabama, they conducted an extensive survey and they wanted to know what makes for a strong marriage, what makes for a strong family. And these two researchers placed an ad, notice, in 48 newspapers across 25 states and asked, if you live in a strong family, if you've witnessed a strong marriage, contact us. We know a lot about what makes marriages and families fail. We know really little about what makes a marriage and family strong. And letters started pouring in. More than 3,000 families responded. It was something called the Family Strength Research Project. It was born. Here's what those researchers discovered. There are six common traits. When they studied those 3,000 different families, they found that there were six common traits that make marriages and families great. And we're going to cover six in sort of a flyover. And then next session, we'll drill down. And tomorrow, we'll drill down as well. Here they are. The stuff that makes homes strong. Number one, irrational commitment. It's the most important factor in strong, happy marriages, relationships that thrive. These relationships are built on rock-solid commitment. People in these relationships are committed to the team. They're committed to doing whatever necessary so that the team can win. They will invest all the time, energy, blood, sweat, tears, joy, laughter, spirit, heart necessary to make the people in those relationships a top priority. They live with a marriage first, family first kind of mentality. They don't let stuff like work, career, a number of other competing priorities take away from family activities or mess with their commitment to their marriage and family. In fact, it goes this far. When they're considering stuff like jobs, relocation, what church they attend, the list goes on, they always use this as a benchmark. Will this help my marriage? Will this help my family? Or will this somehow lead to fragmentation in my marriage and family? Will it weaken our relationship? People in strong relationships, people in strong marriages that thrive are dedicated to one another's happiness, one another's fulfillment. They're committed to helping one another reach their greatest optimal potential. They'll even give up, and this is a big one. They'll give up perceived rights, personal agendas, immediate gratification so that it can help another family member, their spouse, succeed because they get personal joy and fulfillment out of helping somebody else pursue their hopes, dreams, and calling. One more thing related to commitment. They have a high expectation. People in marriages that thrive, they have a high expectation that this relationship will last. They don't go into that relationship with an option B kind of mentality. They go into that relationship believing we're in this for the long haul. Come hell or high water, we're going to last. And do you have that kind of commitment? You'll notice at the end of every one of these sections, I ask you just to evaluate where you're at in that level, in that area, excuse me, of life. I heard a story some time ago with his wife at his bedside. Dying man was reflecting on his life. He looked up at her. He's laying on his deathbed and he said, honey, you've always been there for me. You were there when I lost my job. You were there when I was in that terrible accident. You were right by my side. At time I fell off the roof, you were there to call the ambulance. During those years I went through deep, dark depression, you stood by my side. When I went bankrupt, you were there. Even now, I'm laying here dying, and you're right beside me, just like you've always been. And all of a sudden, he had this expression come across his face. And after a few moments, he looked up and he said, "Oh my gosh, I just realized something. You're bad luck." Relationships that thrive are built on commitment. You know, some of you are aware that wedding vows, first statement about marriage in all the Bible, they're about commitment, right? Unfortunately, we live in a culture that avoids commitment. For instance, Jeremy, this morning I got to go do a workout with he and his brother-in-law at CrossFit. And I bet at a cool place like CrossFit, there's probably a commitment to join that kind of gym. It's probably a 6-month commitment, a 1-year commitment. Now, I'm from Alabama, and I'm not into the CrossFit culture. I enjoyed that ride today. So I go to a gym that is known for the fact that it is no commitment, and it is no judgment zone, and it's the cheapest gym you can find on the planet. It's $10 a month, Planet Fitness, and that's where I go. And it's amazing to me, the entire business model of this gym is built on no commitment. Now this is interesting. I go regularly, so even though there's no commitment, I'm at that gym regularly. But I noticed something today when I went to Jeremy's gym. I got there 30 minutes before it was time to begin the workout, and the class was filled. It looked like superwomen, it was like all women, and I was so thankful that I was not a part of that class because I would have been embarrassed by my lack of ability among these women. I noticed that all of them were very athletic. And then the class we went to, everybody was athletic. I guess it's because, one of the guys talked about bench pressing 275 pounds or something of this nature. And I'm standing over there thinking, my gosh, I don't even want him to look at what I'm bench pressing right now. Just go to another portion of the gym because it's not even going to register. What was amazing to me is I had this epiphany. I thought the people in this gym all look a certain way and it's really athletic and it really is sort of intimidating. The people in my gym, I walk in and I don't for a moment think, I'm intimidated to be around this bunch today. I walk in thinking, this is the no commitment, judgment-free zone. And I like it because among all of you people, I am the slimmest one here. Thank you very much. You pancake-eating, bacon-eating, gravy-eating people. Let me just say, marriages thrive on commitment. Look at the first time marriage is mentioned in the Bible, Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man will leave his father and mother and, see those two words, just say them out loud. And what? Hofas. And by the way, that's a great word. If you mark in your notes, you might want to underline it. The old KJV, which I was raised on, said cleave. And basically, it's this idea. Men will leave father and mother and hold on for dear life to his wife. It's actually from a word, that word hold fast, that means to glue together. To glue together. I want you to notice, particularly for our newlyweds or those in the engaged state of marriage, it says a man will leave father and mother. And the old KJV said he'll cleave to his wife. This is a really important principle. And the first 6 years of our marital strife was largely based upon me not getting this principle. You have to leave before you can really cleave. And sometimes we think in terms of leaving as physically separating, i.e. we don't live in the same house anymore. We don't live under the same roof. But let me just say, it also means emotionally leaving. It means coming to this agreement, hey, we honor and respect the past. We honor and respect our family of origin. We look up to our families in the past, but we're building an entirely new and separate and unique identity. And that means we work together and determine what our story and what the history we're going to write is going to look like. You leave and then you cleave. Some people have never left home, and it blows up one marriage after another, after another. And by the way, not leaving home even involves those people who regularly say, I'll never be like, because we're part of a culture where the landscape is littered with brokenness in families of origin, right? I mean, in the church I lead, we say it's a church for people who've given up on church. And probably a disproportionate percentage of our congregation would be from homes where moms and dads have either split, actually divorced, or they've perpetrated incredible emotional pain because they stayed together but never got their act together and heaped incredible pain on one another in the way they related to one another. So I've met over years families, young families, who go into marriage saying, I will never be like, and they put the blank there, my dad who XYZ, my mom who XYZ. And here's the problem. If your focus is always on what you don't want to be like, that will end up being what you become. You have to have a new model. Instead of I don't want to be like, you have to get a model of I want to become and keep the vision clearly formed in your heart and mind. Some people have never left home. Like another story I told, young girl went to talk with her dad night before she's getting married. She said, Dad, Tom has asked me to marry him. The big day is tomorrow, but I am scared. And Dad looks at her and says, Sweetheart, you have been hoping for this day. You have been dreaming for this day. This is going to be a wonderful day. She said, yeah, Dad, but I don't know what to do. Her dad is getting nervous. What do you mean, sweetheart? You don't know what to do. You want to marry him, right? Oh, yes, I want to marry him. I love him. I want to spend the rest of my life with him. Well, what's the problem? Well, I love you and mom so much. I can't stand the thought of leaving mom. And her dad looked at her and said, don't let that stop you. You can take mama with you. Just here's the biblical principle. You can't take mom with you. You leave and you cleave. Hold fast means to glue, stick to, cling to, adhere to one another. When it comes to marriages that last, it requires a bulldog-like determination. I put the quote for you in your notes by Winston Churchill. I love it. The nose of a bulldog is slanted backwards so that he can continue to breathe without letting go. That's the kind of commitment it takes to really walk out marriage. I love the quote by Yuri Bronfenbrenner about what a family is. He says it's a group which possesses and implements an irrational commitment to the well-being of its members. So I just want to ask you, rate yourself on this. How are we doing in terms of commitment? Am I radically, completely committed to my spouse? Am I radically, completely committed to my family? Or when I'm honest, are there some withholds? Do I withhold in certain areas instead of giving myself fully? Let's go on. Item number two, appreciation, encouragement, and affection. When these two researchers looked at families across America, what makes them great, what makes marriages strong, they found that the second characteristic was appreciation, encouragement, and affection for one another. It was just strong. Strong marriages, Families that thrive are families where people actually care for, encourage, affirm, love one another. They let each other know it on a regular basis. They aren't afraid to express their love, faith, affection in one another. I just want to ask you, do you let the people in your relational world know you love them? Do you let them know you appreciate them? Do you let them know you care? I mean, it's like the husband and wife driving down the road. And the wife looks over at her husband who's driving and says, "Sweetheart, you remember when we were dating? I mean, you would always have your arm around me and you held me close when we drove down the road and you would hold my hand. And when we were at a stoplight, you would reach over and kiss my cheek." And the husband's driving and looks over at his wife and says, "Sweetheart, I hadn't moved. I'm still sitting right here." She wouldn't scoot over a little closer. She said, "Sweetheart, you used to tell me you loved me all the time." He said, "I told you I loved you 20 years ago. If I change my mind, I'll let you know." Is that the kind of relationship you're in? Or do you regularly express faith, love, and devotion? You know, we don't have to work at being critical. How many of you know what I'm talking about? I'm telling you, for me, because my personality is very perfectionistic driven, I don't have to work at being critical. I can find all kinds of flaws. I can find all kinds of shortcomings. But I have to work at being thoughtful, encouraging, affirming, and kind. Check out the passages I put for you in your notes. Philippians 1:3, Paul is talking about a church he loves, and he says, "Every time you cross my mind, I break out in exclamations of thanks to God." Let me just ask you, is that the way you feel about your spouse? Every time I think about her, it just makes me thank God for the gift he gave me. Or how about 1 Thessalonians 5:11, where Paul exhorts the church, "Encourage one another and build each other up." Or how about Ephesians 4:2, "Steadily pour yourselves out for each other in acts of love." And I love the last part, "Alert at noticing differences and quick at mending fences." When I see couples in our church, particularly those who've been married, I don't do a lot of marriage counseling anymore. First of all, I find the process emotionally exhausting. And furthermore, we've got a lot of gifted counselors in our church, and they're about 1 million times better than I. The one thing I do, I love premarital counseling. I love it. I still do it to this day because I love premarriage, because I think that's where you get the opportunity to make the biggest difference. But when I do marriage counseling, because sometimes the people who've been with me for years, when they have a crisis, we've got to talk. And when they come in, they describe to me the culture of their home. Here's what I discover regularly. Most home cultures need to be rebuilt from the ground up. Because as they describe to me the culture of their home, what I find is that criticism is rampant, conflict is rampant, but encouragement is almost non-existent. So there's a little scenario and exercise that I have a couple do, and it's always incredibly uncomfortable, which is so much fun. I just ask them to look at one another, face one another. And this is really interesting. In fact, if you want to do it tonight, you can. I'm not going to ask you to do it right now because I don't want you to get ticked off at me. But it's really a powerful exercise. I ask them to turn one another, and I ask them to hold hands and look at one another and say three things they appreciate about either a person's character, their spouse's character, or specific actions. Just three. Character or actions. Character or actions. Just think of this. Three. We're not talking 15. Three. Three things you appreciate about your spouse's character or his or her actions, something they've done. And I even give them examples. I say, it can be as simple as, thank you so much for the way you take the garbage out every Thursday morning so I don't have to do it. I even give them that example. And then I give them a moment to think, and they turn one another, and I am amazed. I'm always amazed at what happens in the next 10 minutes, because it is often silence. I've even had husbands say, and wives, by the way, the men are not only the neglectors in this field. I'm sorry, I can't think of one thing that I appreciate. And sometimes I break in, you can't think of one thing, not one. The fact that she bore three of your children, that doesn't even cross your mind at this moment. She did that. The fact that, let me ask you, does she keep a moderately clean house? Because I know her standards of cleanliness can differ. But can you at least find your way from the garage to the kitchen to your bedroom? I mean, is that possible? And does she do that since she's a stay-at-home mom? And they will nod. And the woman often, I can't think of one thing. You can't think of one. Does he have a steady job? I mean, he actually works like 5 days a week. And what happens when he gets that money? I mean, has he bought 15 bass boats with the money that he gets? Or does he actually provide for the mortgage on your home? Does he actually help provide a car for you to drive? And all of a sudden, lights start coming on. And eventually, well, now that you put it like that, I do see some things. But it demonstrates the very point that I'm attempting to demonstrate. And the fact is, we don't have to work at criticism. It's part of how we're built. It's our sin nature. But I have to pause to remember this woman I've been living with does so many things selflessly, day in and day out, and never asked for any applause. And this man that the woman is married to, he has faithfully worked a number of years, and he doesn't consume his resources upon himself. He regularly gives to that family. And when they start thinking in terms like that, all of a sudden lights start coming on. And to me, it demonstrates the fact that most cultures in homes need to be rebuilt. And we need to replace a culture of criticism with a culture of praise, a culture of thanksgiving, a culture of gratitude. Does that resonate with anybody in the room here? Let me give you a challenge. Try this, because after we do this and it's really uncomfortable in that setting, I'll give the couple this challenge. I'll say, go home, and every day, here's what I want you to do. At the end of the day, because probably getting kids off to school, that's going to be a disaster if you try to do it in the morning. It's just going to be a train wreck unless your schedule is really different. But at the end of the day, I'd like you to sit down when it's quiet. Kids are in bed. You've got them taken care of. And I just want you to do this. And I warned them, first two nights, it's going to be awkward. It's going to be awkward. But here's what you do to prepare yourself for those evenings. Just keep yourself a little running list. Just keep yourself a running list. When you see him do something good, just write it down in your cheat sheet and stick it in your pocket. When you remember, oh, wow, she did this, just write it down. And then when you sit down, hold hands and look at one another. Make sure the television is not on, because that'll get you into trouble. When she's talking and you veer off to that game, it's going to be a war right there in that moment. So just cut it off and see what happens. This is amazing. When couples do that for a solid week, their relationship isn't transformed, but it starts to change. And then when they do it over a process of a month, and they start rebuilding the culture of their home, and they start not only doing that with husband and wife, but because how many of you know, if husbands and wives are doing this, who else is suffering with this kind of critical kind of spirit? Well, we just start doing that to our kids as well, don't we? We find everything they've done wrong. We pick out every kind of action that didn't live up to our really unrealistic, often, standards. We find more reasons to say no than we say yes. But all of a sudden, when mom and dad start connecting with each other in appreciation and then start realizing, oh my gosh, my kids are actually awesome. They're good. I mean, holy cow. Yeah, their room is a wreck, but they're good. It's amazing the way culture can transform. This was the second characteristic. Let me see how we're doing on time. 15 minutes and we'll take a break. Here's the third one: effective communication with each other. Strong marriages that thrive are relationships where they work on communication. People actually spend time talking and listening to one another just for the purpose of staying connected. These individuals, that they know that communication is about more than sharing information. It's about connecting with one another. So they learn to practice the art of open-ended, rambling conversations. Did you see the definition? What is communication? It's a dynamic process between two or more people that involves talking, listening, and understanding. That's what communication is. Effective communication not only depends on what is being said, but on why it's being said and how it's being shared. Every message we communicate has at least three components. I gave this to you. The content of the message, that's what's being said. The tone of my voice, the vocal inflections, and then the nonverbal communication, the body language I'm presenting. How many of you know it's possible to change the meaning of a word, statement, or question just by changing the tone of my voice and the body language? There was this really smart professor, and he came up with what he calls the 7-38-55 rule. And basically, here's what he said, and we'll cover it in just a moment. But he said 7% of what you say is content, 38% is tone of your voice, 55% is nonverbal communication. But it's possible to change the meaning just by changing tone. I mean, you and your spouse are talking. You look at her, you're relaxed. Maybe you're embracing your spouse and you say, you know how much I love you. And all of a sudden it's tender and it's a moment. You know. But on another occasion, you're in the heat of the moment and you're both ticked off. You cross your arms. She said something smart. And you just say, you know how much I love you. And she doesn't know at all. 10-year study revealed that happily married couples differ from unhappily married couples in this, six things. They talk more to each other. They convey feelings that they understand what is being said. This is that art of reflective listening. They have a wider range of conversation topics available to them. 4, they preserve communication channels and keep them open. 5, they show more sensitivity to the other person's feelings. And 6, they realize the importance of nonverbal aspects of communication. So how are you doing when it comes to communicating? I've given you 4 thoughts at the end of this, and I think they're important. Bullet number 1, quality communication takes time. Not necessarily a lot of time, but a consistent commitment for making time to connect with one another. A communication doesn't just happen. Here's my thought, put it on the calendar. By the way, my wife and I, 34 years in, our two adult daughters, they're self-supporting. Our middle daughter went through some really severe physical problems last year into this year, and she moved back home temporarily so we could help her get better, and she's doing much better now, but basically they're gone, and we don't, when I say we don't see them, we don't have to interact daily with them. The 17-year-old's still at home, and we're very involved in her life, but we have a lot of free time because my 17-year-old is a really independent, all 3 of our daughters are really independent girls, and she just goes and goes. But here's what we found. Our lives, and it's crazy because we thought, you know, we get our kids raised, and boy, our lives will really simplify because we don't have so many activities. We're not being the chauffeur. And what we've noticed at this stage is we're busier than we've ever been. And part of that relates to career because the church is growing. My wife has a career. It's growing. And we love those kinds of things. We love what we get to do. But what we do, we schedule time. And that time is for communicating. For us, it involves a couple of different times. We communicate on a daily basis, but we need one evening for planning. And by that, I mean, we need one night where we sit down and say, okay, here's the week. Here's the direction I'm going in. What direction are you going in? Let's just talk. I don't want that night to be our fun night, by the way. But because it's calendar stuff, it's work, it's Cameron's got this gig going on, she's over here, we need to make it over there, Jack has this, we need to take care of Jack then, blah, 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 here are the church things, on and on and on. It's usually a lot of work trying to figure out who does what, how we get where, yada, yada, yada. I don't want that to be our fun night. So Thursday night is fun night. And by fun night, I mean that's when we go out, we eat somewhere cool. I'm a movie person, so if there's a cool movie, we go out, we eat, we go watch a movie, we get home in time. I'm a very early riser. I'm usually up at about 4:30 every morning. So that movie needs to start before 7 o'clock or I will be asleep in it. It doesn't matter if it's Stephen King's It. I will be asleep watching that movie after. It does not matter. I'm gone. But we come home and then we usually talk. And that's our plan for communication. What is your plan? You've got to have a plan. Because just communication, we're going to communicate throughout the day. We're going to call, say, hey, I love you. How are you doing? How's it going? Had to scoot out of there early. Didn't get to say bye. Yada, yada. That's going to happen. But we need to place value on communication, so it takes time. Second thought, communication involves more than words. I've already hit Dr. Albert Mehrabian's 7-38-55 rule, 7% content, 38% tone of voice, 55% nonverbal communication. Oh, by the way, can I just tell you, this is why, and this is my rule, and this is not a Bible rule, but I think it's a pretty smart rule. Because I've paid the price when I disobeyed this rule. This is why we don't do conflict resolution and we don't do correction via text or email. It's just a no-no to us. We don't do conflict resolution or conflict or correction via text or email. Why? They don't know my tone of voice and they can't see my face. And sometimes you can read a text and if a person is in a bad mood, they'll read it one way. And they're like, that person is so ticked off. I am ticked off. I'll give them a piece of my mind. Here go. Before you know it, you've got text wars going. We just don't do that. If it's affirmation, if it's praise, great. If it's a request, could you pick up some bacon and eggs? Great. But correction or some kind of conflict, no to text and email. Let's do that in person. So we're looking each other eyeball to eyeball. And if we can't do it in person, let's pick up the phone. And it's amazing. My wife is like the queen of texting. In fact, we reviewed, my kids wanted to review our bill because we got a really high AT&T bill when we were with the AT&T bill and I about lost it. And I just knew it was my kids that were on the plan. And my 17-year-old was like, Dad, I hardly text. And I mean, I'm not streaming Netflix. So I know it can't be me. You might want to look at Mom. This is my 17-year-old. And I looked at Mom, and Mom's texts were like in a different stratosphere. I said, sweetheart, like you've got 6 times the number of texts of our 17-year-old. Do you know how much you're texting? She's very talented at it, by the way. I mean, she can do it without, I mean, it's just amazing. I'm very slow. Third bullet. Communication requires developing the art and skill of listening. I love I love the quote I put for you in your notes by David Osberger, great counselor. Love is listening. Love is the opening of your life to another through sincere interest, simple attention, sensitive listening, compassionate understanding, and honest sharing. An open ear is the only believable sign of an open heart. You learn to understand life. You learn to live as you learn to listen. And I didn't put this for you in your notes, but I did put it on the screens, James 1:19 out of the Message. I love it. Post this at all intersections, dear friends. Lead with your ears. Follow up with your tongue. Let anger straggle along in the rear. That is a great verse worth remembering. Fourth bullet, remember that small talk isn't really all that small. But boy, how many of you have kids? Right? I tell you what, I love being a daddy. And I've loved every stage of development with our kids. I loved it when they were really small toddlers and when they were in that adolescent stage, teenage stage. Those were great years. I mean, we loved that. And right now, I've still got a 17-year-old and 29-year-old. Here's what I've learned with my kids. The time I've spent with them in small talk, where we're just talking. No agenda, just talking. Let's go do, what do you want to do? Because with my girls, I would usually take them out on a weekly date. That small talk opened the opportunity for significant talk. I encourage husbands and wives, the small talk, it's those fun times with Janet, i.e. Thursday night where we're going to Babalu or El Barrio or wherever it is in Birmingham, we like to go, and we're sitting there talking with no agenda but to get to know each other once again. That matters. Fourth, enjoyable time together. Hey, I know we've got a lot of people from other churches. Sunday morning at the church at Lake Travis, I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about families that thrive are families that have fun. Marriages that thrive are marriages where husbands and wives have fun. And that means in every aspect of the word fun. There's this great study, Willard Harley. Anybody read his book, His Needs, Her Needs? Great book, incredible book. Willard Harley did research for 25 years. What are the most significant needs of men? What are their basic needs? What are the most significant needs of women? Let me ask you, and you can say it out loud since this is a smaller group and it's conference. What do you think the number one need of men? We're talking husbands. What do you think the number one need of men is? You can say it out loud if you want to venture a guess, and it's okay. It's probably what's coming to your mind. The number one need of most men. Anybody want to say it out loud? Sex. You're absolutely right. This is Willard Harley, 25 years. He says sexual affection, the number one need of most husbands. What was number two for most husbands? No. Respect was number three. That's great. Number two was, get this, recreational companionship. Sounds just like sex. I mean, it's amazing. Here's what he meant. He meant the man likes his wife to do things with him. I mean, what, going fishing. Is this amazing or what? A man can go fishing with a group of guys and they can be out all day fishing. And when they get home, the woman will say, how was it? Good. What'd y'all do? Fish. What'd y'all talk about? Nothing. What? Because get this, guys don't have to talk to have a good time. I know that is amazing, but it is true. We can be together for hours and just sort of nod at each other. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Really? And when we finish up, it's like, man, that was so awesome. Let's do it again next week. Ladies thrive with communication. What do you think the number one need of most women was? Now remember, men, sexual affection, recreational companionship, and third was respect. That's actually, and that's interesting to me. respect, because that would match what Paul says in Ephesians 5 when he gives us an exhortation, wives, see to it that you respect your husbands. It's interesting to me that Willard Harley's research says that's one of the top things men need. What do you think number one for women was? Thing they most need. This is Willard Harley. Anybody know? Very close there, non-sexual physical affection.
That's exactly what I meant.
I knew it. It's interesting. The guy is wired for sex and the woman is wired for, just hold me. Just hold me. And then secondly, you're exactly right when you talked about, what how did you say it exactly? They want companionship and communication. And the third thing they wanted was family security. In other words, to know that their husband is committed to the well-being and welfare of the family. It's really interesting the way we're wired up. And I went off on that diatribe to say, here's what husbands and wives have to figure out with those differences. How do we have fun with these kinds of differences? How do we still have an enjoyable life together with these? Fifth, we're going to talk about this in the morning, so I'm just going to fill in the blanks. Successful management of stress, crisis, and conflict. Marriages that thrive know how to handle conflict. And boy, we're going to talk about that in the morning. I really hope you'll be back. I'm excited about that. And here's the sixth thing. And we'll close with this and then take a break. And we've got dessert. Is that right? Cool. Spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being. This is really interesting to me. This research, by the way, this research, it was conducted 30 years ago. It is still being cited today. It's still being cited by all kinds of relational experts as being valid for today. What's interesting, it wasn't a faith-based study. And these professors weren't doing a Christian-based study, but this kept coming up again and again and again. Faith matters. The psalmist said it this way, Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. And here's the quote I put on the screen. The foundation for strong, resilient, life-giving relationships is keeping God at the center of those relationships. And you've seen this before, so we don't have to take a lot of time with it. It's sort of that idea of the equilateral triangle. A triangle where all sides are equal. Should either side of the triangle be broken or weakened, the strength of the triangle is dramatically impacted. It's the same in marriages that thrive. The glue that holds marriages together is keeping God at the center. So if you want to put God at the center of that equilateral triangle, right there at the top, and then at the bottom is the husband and the wife. As they commit to one another and they both commit to God, you've got the substance for a great marriage. Now, let me talk to you about how we make faith work in our relationship, and I'll just give you these bullets. Jan and I, when we were really young, I was 8 years old and she was about 10, we committed our life to Jesus Christ. And by the way, I know I said 8, and I know some people devalue children's conversions. I can tell you this, for me, it was real. For me, it was real. My dad wouldn't let me be baptized for 2 years because he wasn't certain I understood the meaning of it at 10. I was baptized. I still remember baptism at 10. Throughout my teens, my favorite place to go, even though it was very archaic, I didn't know any better. I was in love with Jesus Church, and I wanted to be there. And I wanted to find out about how to get closer to Jesus. And my wife committed her life to Jesus. So when I talk about the grace of God being irresistible, I believe it went back to those commitments we made when I was 8, she was 10. We never could get away from those commitments to Christ. Second, our involvement in the local church. You've got some great churches represented here. Man, I can't imagine life outside the context of a local church. Now, I'm a pastor, but I'll tell you this. If I were not a pastor, I would be the best member of a local church a pastor had because I love Jesus Church. I love it. And there was a period back in 2007 when I didn't know if I would continue pastoring, but I wanted to be a member. Or we call it owners at A2 Church. And I mean, be a part, commit to a local church. Build strong relationships with people who share your values. Ashley stepped out for a moment ago, for a moment to get desserts ready. And that's really apropos because I can brag on her parents. Jan and I, when we were really young pastors, we were introduced to the Lombards, Wayne and Donna, and we saw a couple that seemed to really like and love each other, and we saw a couple that had kids that weren't absolute train wrecks. They, Ashley at that time was a teenager. Lindsay was a little younger. I think I met her when she may have been in third or fourth grade. And these kids were amazing. They were fun to be around. And we would go out to eat dinner with them on Sunday nights and sit and talk with Wayne and Donna. And the kids were like a pleasure to be around. They were like awesome. So, you know, it was then that we asked Wayne and Donna, would you share with us how we build this kind of family? Because we want this. We want our kids to like us, like your kids like you. And our kids were, I mean, really, really like baby small. And here's the cool thing. Today, our 29-year-old, she and her husband, they're down at our house all the time. Our 24, 25-year-old, she's somewhere between that. I'm blowing that tonight, I believe. But she moved back when she got sick, but she's really connected with us, even when she doesn't live with us, very connected. And our 17-year-old, and I'm not saying this is because of any spirituality, so this is not, our 17-year-old, we love her, and we love hanging out with her, but it's the relationships that have poured into us that made that possible. Have you got some marriages that you look to? Because people like the Lombards that poured into us, they gave us a model to build on. Four, this is a big one. How about praying and talking about God's word together? That's big for us in keeping God at the center. We pray regularly together, and we love reading God's word. And I know that works out different. By the way, my wife and I are as different as Derek and Lindsay. I'm an early guy. 4:30 in the morning, usually, I am up and at it. My wife, you know, she'll wake me up at night reading her iPad with the glow of that light because she is a night owl. I mean, she seems to get energized at like 10, 11, midnight. And I'm like waking up thinking, what in heaven's name could be going on that's interesting at this time? So we're really wired differently, but we've learned to integrate this in our life. And then serving together. Take a missions trip together. Our church does service projects in the community. Go out and serve. We recently went to a high school in a difficult part of town, and we spent a day sprucing up that high school, and it was really cool to be out there with my wife just serving. So those are those six characteristics. Jeremy, does somebody need to come and tell them about the break? It's a break. All right, we'll come back. We'll wrap up.